The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. NHBR station-wide series The First Decade is looking at how income disparities in the lives of children can affect their choices later in life. Today, we're looking at the way kids play, which research shows is becoming increasingly stratified. A 2012 report from the American Academy of Pediatrics found that schools in low-income areas are more likely to cut recess, and that the costs of sports equipment, fees, and travel are prohibitive to many low-income families. Behavioral research reveals that low-income children are less likely to participate in sports and display lower levels of outdoor play. But what about indoor play? Greg Topo is USA Today's national education and demographics reporter. In a new book, he argues that electronic games have been unfairly maligned for making children fat, violent, and lazy, and that today's video games can be one way of leveling the playing field. Greg, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So technology, games in general, often thought to be the root of brain rot for children or the downfall of education. Your book argues that games actually make kids smarter. Broadly, how?
Well, you know, at the very basis of this is this idea that games give kids access to material in a way that really sparks their imagination and that allows them to try out the material, fail, come back with a better plan, and really sort of learn at their own pace and learn more deeply. And that's something that, you know, school has been trying to do for centuries and has always struggled to do. And I think one of the things that excited me about this topic was that games presented a way to do that we hadn't seen before.
Well, you make the case that this is not just about play and access to learning, but forging friendships, which seems counterintuitive when I think of, you know, the solitary nature of playing games.
Sure. I mean, from the very beginning, the world of video games really was about playing with other people. When you think about, you know, the first important video game, which was something like Pong, I mean, you played against another person. Obviously, a lot of games since then have been these solitary games where you're playing against a computer. But, you know, if you were to kind of drop into your typical teenager's after-school game-playing sessions, more often than not, they would be playing against their friends or with their friends, you know, either in the same room or, you know, at a distance, you know, through the internet. I think as adults, we don't really understand the role that socializing has begun playing in gameplay. And it's really, really fascinating to me and something I think we just sort of miss.
Well, access is something that we're talking about with our series, and you're talking about access to material and learning.
Sure.
But I'm thinking of in these multiple player games, you know, where you can be playing with people at any given time from people all over the world. No one knows what you look like, what you're wearing, what kind of house you live in. Can games also be a kind of equalizer?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the most interesting interviews I did was actually a series of interviews with a teacher who found exactly that sort of the social constructs sort of melted when she started using games in the classroom, because kids started judging each other not on, you know, the cut of their clothes or how expensive their shoes were or, you know, where they lived, but how well they played the game and how helpful they were and how smart they were. Really fascinating. I mean, it happened very quickly. I think that's a phenomenon that a lot of players have kind of found a lot of comfort in. It's a real, in a way, kind of a real meritocracy. Mm. That's powerful for a young person.
Well, your book is, of course, about games for learning, but also healing was a big eye-opener for me. You spoke with a game designer. Now, this is someone who was diagnosed with ADD at a young age, spent most of his life on Ritalin and Adderall, and now envisions games as a kind of alternative to prescription drugs. What's his story?
This is one of my favorite people in the book. I'm a young game designer named Lat Ware, who grew up in North Carolina, and as you said, you know, was diagnosed at a very young age with ADD, began taking medication every morning, didn't like the way it made him feel, and thought, you know, I really need to do something about this. He was also, I think, kind of really, in a kind of a wonderful way, just obsessed with Star Wars from a very young age, from 6 years old, and decided that he wanted to be a Jedi Knight because he loved the way they moved objects with their minds.
Well, who wouldn't?
Yeah, exactly. but unlike most of us, he did something about it, and he actually he went to school, you know, after high school, went to college to learn how to design video games, and then came across this EEG headset that did exactly that, that used your brain waves to move objects on screen. And it took a couple of years to develop this game that amusingly is called Throw Trucks with Your Mind. And I played it, and it actually, that is what you do. It is exactly as advertised. It's a game that requires the player to be calm and focused, and you see calm and focused meters dead center in the middle of the screen. And the more calm and the more focused you are, the more control you have over what happens in the game. And really remarkable. You actually play the game essentially hands-free.
And this is actually being tested now by the FDA, hoping to market it as a substitute for drugs like Ritalin and Adderall.
Yeah, that's right. I talk in the chapter about how there's this kind of quiet foot race to create the first prescription-strength video game. And that's not a metaphor. You know, that's real. They're trying to get approval for a game that a doctor can prescribe. And I think it's still a few years off, but I think it's coming.
He's not alone. The psychiatrist Bruce Wexler, someone else you interview, he's at Yale. He also advocates using video games as a kind of therapy. So what is he doing? And tell us how that's being tested.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so Bruce, you know, as you say, you know, he's this Yale psychiatrist who actually started investigating this field 20 years ago. You know, he became one of the first people to use something called CCRT, computerized cognitive remediation, to help people suffering from schizophrenia. And one of the things that he found was that if you kind of break the disease down into component parts and strengthen certain functions like memory and attention, you can really have a great impact on this. And you can, you know, people can hold down jobs and are more sort of healthy, basically. And he essentially took that knowledge and started developing games for things like ADHD. And he actually, interestingly enough, he is one of the people who has decided that, you know, sitting and playing a game is not enough. He has also incorporated exercise into the regimen. And, you know, I mean, that's something a lot of ADHD therapists have recommended for a long time, that exercise is really, really helpful.
Are video games rotting your kids' brains? Well, Greg Topo is with us. He's USA Today's National Education and Demographics reporter and author of a book that says digital play can actually make kids a lot smarter. There are a number of examples in the book about how gaming is being used to change kids' cognitive functions. Well, we're wondering if that works for kids across the economic and social spectrum. Bruce Wexler has also been working on therapies that remediates key deficits in poor kids' lives. What specifically has he done in that area?
You know, this is just kind of more, I think, along the same lines. You know, what he found was that, you know, like a lot of people, that low-income kids, they're not as cognitively stimulated in their daily lives as middle-class kids. You know, so he's actually focused very much on things like executive function. And what he's found is that it's not really a metaphor. If you can help exercise that, kids can be more successful. Mm-hmm. He's got a very interesting term. He calls it school lunch program for the brain. And I think that's kind of an interesting way to think about it.
We're talking about specifically so-called educational games or games for change. How about your everyday games like Assassin's Creed or Madden NFL? Do those actually do anything cognitively or socially for kids?
When you step back and think about them, they do a lot cognitively. When you're playing these games, it's really cognitively demanding just to get through the game. You know, there's this idea of hard fun that is kind of a bedrock principle in the game design world. As people from the outside looking in, you know, we tend to think that gamers think games are fun because they're easy, right? You know, it's kind of a way to kick back and just not think too hard.
Mm-hmm.
And what a gamer would say is, no, games are fun because they're hard. They're challenging. They're requiring something of me that I may not be able to do. And oftentimes I can't do, so I have to come back again and again and again. You know, the term I use is, you know, you have to come back with a better plan next time. But one of the things that games have always done really well is let the player fail and then come back right away.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially sort of invisible, you know, that there's no delay between you failing and you starting upright again, you know.
Getting back on the horse,
mm-hmm. Yeah, with no judgment and no, you know, no fuss at all.
Well, in the book, you say that there's a Stanford scholar that found that a lot of teachers are skeptical of technology or resistant to changing things. So we've seen these impressive results, but what about schools that are reluctant to incorporate video games in the classroom or can't afford to?
I think the reluctance is melting a little bit because so many people in real life have experiences with these games. You know, I mean, I don't know about you personally, but I imagine you have a smartphone and maybe someone in your family has a tablet. You know, people are having experiences with games at a very kind of basic, quiet level, and they're starting to see the power of these tools. So I think that's sort of melting some of people's resistance. And your question about, you know, historically why this hasn't worked is because I think, in general, I think the tools haven't been sophisticated enough. They've been kind of standardized in a way. Here we're finding, I think, that these tools can really, really be customized to what students need to do. And, you know, the second part of your question about the cost, I mean, one of the most interesting things to me is that a lot of these tools, a lot of some of the really sophisticated tools, they're consciously being distributed for free. So I think the digital divide, I mean, in a way, I mean, if this were like this great big Cadillac expensive tool, I wouldn't be as excited because, sure, you know, if you spend enough money, you can do almost anything. I think the real potential in this is to bring things to schools at a very low cost. If we can't do that, I think there's a way in which we've kind of failed.
Well, Greg Topo, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Greg Topo is USA Today's National Education and Demographics reporter. He's also a former teacher and author of The Game Believes in You, How Digital Gameplay Can Make Our Kids Smarter. And you can see all the stories from our special series, The First Decade, at nhpr.org. There's also a terrific infographic on how income affects kids' participation in enrichment activities. It's again on our series page for The First Decade at nhpr.org. And now to a firsthand account of how games can bridge some gaps, this time between nations. When John Hunter started teaching in Charlottesville, Virginia, more than 30 years ago, he wanted to get his students to think about important global issues. So he invented the World Peace Game. Fourth graders are divided into countries and given a series of international crises that they solve through collaboration. John Hunter sat down for StoryCorps with two former World Peace Game players, 11-year-old Julianne Swope and 20-year-old Irene Newman.
Sometimes World Peace Game feels like, you know, the weight of the world on your shoulders. This is exploding over here. This is firing over there. This is spilling oil. And I just look at the board and I say to myself, oh my gosh, I need to fix this. And you, Mr. Hunter, you are always saying, there's only one thing I'll say when you make these decisions, know the consequences. And I think that's actually pretty fair, and that should apply in real life too. What do you hope we learn from the World Peace Game?
I think how to make people not suffer so much.
Yeah.
I think I now hope the game also helps people be more compassionate and kinder.
And that's what I've learned, that no matter where you're from, your background, you can still connect with someone else that you've never even met before.
I'm Irene Newman. I played the World Peace Game 10 years ago, and now I'm studying peace, war, and defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Third grade, I thought I was going to be president of the United States.
I remember you, too. I remember the pigtails, the brownie uniform, the glasses. You were an intellectual, a third grade intellectual.
I had decided that we were going to win the peace game, and the way that was going to work was I was going to take over everything. And I started on that path and quickly ran into a lot of problems. I really began to understand as we were playing the game, we found peace more through cooperation with one another. And I actually found the other day on my 13th birthday, you sent me these two pages of advice, but I just wanted to give it to you and see if there were any particular points of advice that you had anything to say about.
Oh, you caught me, Irene, because I always claim to never give advice. Number 22, most problems are actually pretty simple to solve. We superimpose so much on them that they become so complex. What, you like that one? What is that?
I do like that one.
What does that mean for you?
Well, actually, as we've been talking about the World Peace Game, it does make you think that if a bunch of third and fourth graders can look at problems and find a solution, that sometimes the world problems are more simple than we think.
If we just let fourth graders and third graders handle things,
our world could be in a different situation than it is now.
Sometimes I wonder. I'm almost afraid adults are playing the real World Peace Game and we're not doing so well at it. But third graders and fourth graders routinely fix everything and make everything work okay. Mm-hmm. If just one of them gets through 10 years, 15 years later, they may save us all. And so I'm kind of hoping that you may be in a position to do that someday.
We'll see.
We will. I'll be watching, too.
That's John Hunter, inventor of the World Peace Game, with former students Irene Newman and Julianne Swope at StoryCorps. And now a story of how games divide. On the surface, pinball seems like an innocuous enough game. Simply bat steel balls around, rack up some points, and try not to lose a turn. But there is a darker trend lurking beneath the bright facade of the pinball machine. KALW's Angela Johnston brings us the story.
Ellen Frankel slips the last of her quarters into the medieval madness pinball machine and wipes the sweat off her forehead. It's her second game of the night, and she's trying to get a new high score. And although she is shy to admit it, Frankel is a real pinball wizard.
I kind of do have a pinball claim to fame, yes. I was female world champion in 1994, and so I was top 10 in the world at one point.
She's the only woman who has ever won a national pinball championship. And tonight, she's joined by a dozen other women at the High Life Bar in Oakland. They're all members of Bells and Chimes, a women's only pinball league.
Everybody knows that they have this one thing in common, and it's just kind of like a starting point to forge actually new friendships and also have a little bit of fun at the same time.
All right, so let's play pinball. Ooh.
Ooh. The league started a year ago when Eka Schneider, who's a nationally ranked pinball player herself, noticed that she was just about the only woman to show up at tournaments.
I thought it would be a nice way to encourage more women to get into pinball if I had a women-only league.
So she founded Bells and Chimes. Schneider tells me that pinball's gender issues run deeper than the images of bikini-clad women plastered over many of the machines.
Boobs, boobs, boobs. There's just boobs all over pinball machines, all of them.
Or the sexist notion of rescuing damsels in distress. It's about access. The top 25 players in the world, according to the International Flipper Pinball Association, are all men. At a national competition last fall that attracted 400 players, Schneider said fewer than 40 women competed. Two of them were members of Bells and Chimes. And for female pinball players in the Bay Area, the male-dominated pastime isn't always the most welcoming.
It can be pretty intimidating to walk into a room full of like 60 dudes and you're the only girl and you don't know anybody.
Not to mention the assumptions that exist before you even walk in the room.
When I'm playing on location, I am constantly having men approach me and like try to tell me really basic things about how to play pinball. But there's just always this assumption that you don't know what you're doing.
So at Bells and Chimes, Schneider tries to create an environment that stresses fun over top scores.
I am Sally, and I want Goldwing's soundtrack to be like the soundtrack of my life.
And when someone does well, everyone celebrates.
It's good just to, I think, have more women playing and being visible about playing.
The league's success has even led to the opening of a second chapter in New York City.
There's definitely, in the past year or two, I've seen so many more women at tournaments and competitive events. So women in pinball are becoming a lot more visible than they have been in the past.
Did you just get the second highest score for that game?
Well, it's a new game in here, so it's, yeah, for now. For now, yes, it's the second, but it won't last long, I promise.
For Frankel, the score is just another number. What's more important is the feeling she gets from playing.
Each pinball game is different. It's not just each machine being different. Every game that you play is different. It's controlled carom in a way. It's lovely.
And she says to be playing with a group of women that all feel the same way, it's even better than winning.
Scoops again!
In Oakland, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
A few days ago, I went into a studio and Googled the word happiness. All right, so here are some headlines about happiness. Want to find happiness? Do this one thing in the shower. 4 steps to finding joy and happiness in your bipolar life. Wow, that's kind of specific. Why are older Danish women so happy? Money really does buy happiness in one map. Depressed Botox may be the key to happiness. We all know that. The world, it would seem, is obsessed with the notion that there is a secret to happiness. And judging by the number of books and articles on the subject, it's a formula we have yet to discover. One of the many people exploring what it means to be happy is the French philosopher Frédéric Lenoir. His new book, Happiness, A Philosopher's Guide, is not your typical self-help book, but it does contain the optimistic view that lasting happiness is indeed possible. And Frédéric Lenoir, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello, Virginia.
You are a philosopher yourself, and so many influential thinkers through the years have considered what makes us happy, from Aristotle to Voltaire. So what are some of the ideas about happiness that feel the most real or resonant to you?
As you said, there are many, many books which try to tell you how to be happy in 10 lessons, and they give many formulas or recipes. But I think it's not so simple. And philosophers show that happiness is something complex, which is made up of many factors, our environment, genetics, relationship, health, and of course our decision to be happy. And so we have to think. And if we think well, I think we can live better.
But that's the challenge, thinking well. There have been so many quotes and ideas about the nature of happiness that we hear again and again. We hear money cannot buy you happiness. You can't rely on others to make you happy. That happiness is a state of mind. But we either don't absorb these lessons or we don't believe them. Why do you think it is that we resist them?
I think there are, of course, many theories about happiness. And as you said, the most important thing is to understand that happiness is a state of mind. I would say it's a state of being. People confuse pleasure and happiness all the time. Pleasure is a short-lived experience. Happiness is a state of being. You get pleasure when you get satisfaction from a need or desire. And you're happy because you feel good inside yourself. And in order to do that, you have to find with your reason the correct pleasures and experience those pleasures in moderation. Happiness is a quest for balance, harmony, serenity. And many people, when they say I'm happy, they only have good pleasures because they lack the job they have, they lack the family, they have pleasure in life. But if tomorrow they lose a job, if they separate, and they will be very unhappy.
I think so many of us have the idea that we are supposed to be happy. Does that pressure to be happy get in the way of actually being happy?
I think the pressure is not good for happiness. Happiness must not be an obligation. I was in the United States for 2 months to learn English 3 months ago. And then I was very surprised in New York City that all people said, oh, I'm so happy, I'm very happy. And I was thinking, it's not always true. And I thought that if they said, I'm unhappy or it's difficult, people will think they are losers, you know, and that it would be difficult in their culture to say that everything is not perfect. And in France, it's exactly the opposite. Most of the people, if you ask them, are you happy? They will say, oh, I'm not so happy. It's difficult. Life is so difficult. But they are quite happy also. But they don't want to say they are happy because they don't want to be obliged to be happy. And I think it's very interesting to discover this cultural difference.
It is interesting. I mean, there's also the sense of sort of competition about being happy. What is the quote from Seneca? No one will be happy if tormented by the thought that another is happier.
That's right. We don't have to compare because there will be always someone who is happier, who is richer, who is more successful. And then if we compare to other people, we will be always unhappy. And it's the reason why also Émile Zola, you know, the French writer, he said that it's to be poor in Paris, and we can say the same in the American big cities, to be poor in Paris is to be poor twice, because you will compare yourself to other people who are richer than you.
Right, the sort of relative deprivation is revealed. But I'm glad you're talking about environments, because there is a lot of debate, of course, among sociologists and psychologists and other scientists about the question of nature versus nurture. You're suggesting that one can adopt a state of mind that sees happiness. In fact, you give an example in the book of a woman who's in a concentration camp and keeps a journal that is all about not letting that horrible experience rob her spirit or determination to be happy. How much of our happiness is dependent on our surroundings versus our attitude?
The first philosopher who asked this question was Aristotle. He underlined the crucial point that an individual's capacity for happiness has three factors. First, and for him least influential, are exterior conditions, environment, family, society, culture. He said the second point, more important, is luck. Our lucky star, our divine providence, that gave us a good nature. We will say today, a good genes. And third, our practice, knowledge, spiritual exercise, virtues, behavior. And what is very interesting is that today, the professor Sonia Lubominsky from University of California said exactly the same thing. She explained that happiness depends for 10% on external conditions, 50% on genetics, and 40% on our voluntary activities. Of course, environment is important. Of course, genetics and luck is important. But you can also decide to be happy, and you can practice, and you can do many things that will help you to be happier, even if you had bad genes, if you are no lucky. Everyone can be happy if he decide to be happy.
Well, when you're talking about philosophers, by and large, they have not always been the best examples of happy individuals, have they? Should we really be looking to them for advice?
It's a good question. I think it depends on philosophers. And I will tell you, when I made this book, I discovered something very interesting. The philosophers who didn't believe in happiness, because there are many philosophers who said happiness doesn't exist.
Right.
Only pleasure exists. And when you have a lot of pleasure, you say I'm happy. But only pleasure exists. Those philosophers were not happy. They were unhappy. Like Schopenhauer, you know, like Freud, like Kant. Many philosophers said happiness is impossible to reach happiness because they were unhappy. And other philosophers, like Montaigne, like Epicurus, like Spinoza, the Dutch philosopher from 17th century, were very happy, and they said it's possible to reach happiness. So I think, of course, it depends on the experience of the philosophers. And something that was also very interesting for me to discover is that some philosophers said that to be happy, the most important thing is to live in the present time, to focus on the present time. And today, cognitive science say exactly the same thing. So it's interesting to understand that the modern science can confirm, can say the same thing than old philosophers from 2,000 years.
How about the philosopher Frederick Lenoir? Would you say that researching and writing this book has made you a happier person?
I think that I would tell you my own experience. When I was a teenager, I was not so happy. I think I had a low self-esteem, and I decided to work on myself. I read philosophers, I went to therapy, I learned to meditate, and in the end, I got to know and to love myself better, and then step by step, I became truly happy. So it's the reason why I decided to write this book and to try to understand what is happiness, because it was my journey, and I tried to share this experience with other people.
Well, Frederick Lenoir, thank you for sharing that experience with us.
Thank you so much, Virginia. It was a good pleasure to speak with you.
Frederick Lenoir is a philosopher, a radio talk show host, and author. His newest book has recently been translated into English by Andrew Brown, and it's called Happiness, A Philosopher's Guide. There's more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. As the days become longer and warmer, many New Englanders make way for the coast in search of ocean breezes and a cool dip. We share the beach with several species of shorebirds circling overhead or skittering across the sand in a delicate dance with the waves, searching for food. But as the climate changes and the coastline shifts, shorebirds and the food they rely on to survive is becoming more and more scarce. Our next guest followed a specific shorebird on its annual migration from one end of the globe to the other and discovered how its life is inextricably linked to our own. Deborah Kramer is a visiting scholar at MIT and author of The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and One Epic Journey. Deborah, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So your book looks at the relationship between the red knot, it's a type of sandpiper, and the horseshoe crab. But we're going to focus on the red knot. Tell us a little bit about this bird first. What do they look like?
Well, they're about the size of a robin, and they weigh about as much as a coffee cup. And in the winter, they're kind of non-distinct. They're grayish birds. But in the spring, starting about now, they develop this beautiful red russet color plumage on their bellies.
Would we have been likely to see them on a New England shore with their long beaks?
We were more likely to see them in the 1800s, but it's definitely still possible to see them now. I was checking on the eBird sightings, and they come through the coast of New Hampshire in both the spring and the fall when they return. And I've actually seen them on the beaches and marshes behind my house in Gloucester, Massachusetts.
Mm. When did you first encounter the red knot?
I first saw this bird on Delaware Bay, where the greatest concentration of them are in the spring. Delaware Bay is the avian Serengeti for spring shorebird migration on the east coast of the United States. Mm. I had never seen so many birds concentrated on such a small piece of beach in my entire life. And the birds were scurrying across the sand in flocks so thick I couldn't even see the sand. And I wondered, one, where they'd been coming from that they were so hungry, and two, where they were going that they were in such a hurry to eat so much so fast.
So you followed the bird to find out its migratory pattern. So where'd you start and where did it take you?
I began on a remote, windswept beach in Tierra del Fuego at the southern tip of South America along the Strait of Magellan. Mm-hmm. It's a beach that extends for about 64 miles along the strait, and it has a vast, vast mud flat where the tide recedes 7 miles. So if you stand on the beach and look out to the sea, you can't even see the water when it's low tide.
Hmm.
So we waited probably 3 or 4 hours on the beach, and as the water came in, the birds came in to feed with the incoming tide. And when the tide was high, I found myself standing in about ankle-deep water, surrounded by several thousand birds.
Wow.
It was truly, truly beautiful.
I can imagine. And then how far do they go to get up north?
Well, they stop in a few other places in South America along the way, but basically it's about a 7,500-mile trip to Delaware Bay, which is their last big staging area before they go to the Arctic.
And how many miles, then, do they go at a stretch?
Well, on this route coming up from South America, they sometimes do 4 or 5,000 miles, 5 or 6 or 7 days, nonstop.
Amazing. How about you? So, how did you travel?
Well, I traveled with considerably more luggage and considerably more difficulty than they did. It's pretty easy, for example, to go to Delaware Bay and drive to a beach and walk onto a viewing area near the beach. In many of the other places I traveled, it required going by plane, going by bush pilot, taking cars, ATVs, sleds. It took a lot for me to chase these birds.
How did you locate them from place to place?
In Delaware Bay, as I said, it's a lot easier. You just drive up and down the coast of New Jersey or the coast of Delaware, and there's a limited number of places where they'll be, and you can usually find them. In the Arctic, it was a completely different matter. We flew to Baffin Island, and from there, bush pilots took us to a small bay on an island just south of the Arctic Circle. And we spent every day for probably, I think it was at least 3 weeks, walking 8 to 10 miles every day, looking for the birds and their nests.
Wow. Well, there, let's get to this narrow edge idea. Their long journey is dependent on finding an ample food supply. And this interdependence with the ancient crab, the horseshoe crab, comes into play. What happens when they cannot refuel?
Well, in Delaware Bay, when they can't get enough crab eggs to eat, they eat the eggs of the horseshoe crab. Each egg is about the size of a pin. And what they need to do in Delaware Bay is double their weight in 10 days so they can make this flight up into the Arctic and still have enough fuel in case the snow hasn't melted yet and there's nothing to eat. Mm. If they aren't able to double their weight, then the survival rate of the birds goes way down. So, for example, in the past, it used to be that if you had 100 knots, 90 of those 100 knots would be sure to gain the weight they needed. When the number of horseshoe crabs started declining precipitously, only 30 out of every 100 birds would gain the weight they needed.
Mm. The red knot is now on the endangered species list. Since when, and what are the numbers?
As I was finishing writing the book, the Fish and Wildlife Service announced that they were going to list the bird as threatened. So in January, that designation went into effect. In the past 30 or so years, the population in Delaware Bay, where it's counted every year, had plummeted by 75%. That's a very rapid loss.
I'm speaking with Deborah Kramer. She followed the red knot, a tiny shorebird, 7,500 miles on its annual migratory journey to learn more about its life cycle and climate change. In fact, you refer to the red knot as the 21st century's canary in the coal mine. So how is this shorebird and others like it, because there's been a huge loss of birds since in the last 30 years, how is the shorebird and others like it linked to climate change?
Well, first of all, I guess I'd like to say that you raise a really good point. The red knot is not the only bird, shorebird, whose population is plummeting. I was able to look at the state of a number of other shorebirds, and many of them, too, have also dropped between 50 and 80% since I was graduated from college, so that the total of the birds we were able to look at, the loss has been some 12 million birds. Mm. That's a lot of birds. Climate change hasn't been what has contributed to that problem. But going forward, it's going to be another difficult thing we have to deal with. And I'll give you one example. When the birds come north from Tierra del Fuego, they're both following food sources, but they're also following the light. It's the change in the light, the beginning of the winter in Tierra del Fuego, that starts these birds on their northern migration. The horseshoe crabs that are coming into Delaware Bay to lay their eggs at spring's highest tides, those animals are coming in because the water is warming. So if the water begins to warm earlier and earlier, it may be that the horseshoe crabs spawn before the birds arrive to be able to eat the eggs. Yeah. That's a projection. We don't actually know what is going to happen. These birds have an uncanny ability to locate the best sources of food that are around. I have seen this over and over and over again. So whether they're going to be able to adjust to that piece of it, we don't know. One thing, though, is that as the water rises, the beaches erode more quickly, and the birds have less room to eat, and the horseshoe crabs have less room to spawn. So in the meantime, a lot of the Delaware Bay beaches are being refurbished with sand so that both the birds and the crabs and the people living along Delaware Bay will have more room.
So what is being done to help protect the red knot?
Right now, a couple of things are being done. One is there has been regulation to reduce the number of horseshoe crabs that humans are taking for bait in order to help make sure that there's enough food for the birds. Those regulations are probably not stringent enough, and with this listing, perhaps they will become more stringent. Another activity that's going on is that when beaches are being rebuilt, for example, all the Hurricane Sandy devastated beaches that are being rebuilt, there's going to be a lot more coordination with the Geological Survey to make sure that the kind of sand that's put on the beach is sand that horseshoe crabs like.
Hmm. Where are the red knots now?
Well, right now they are just coming into Delaware Bay. I got an email from a scientist who works for the British Trust for Ornithology, and he sent me an email that said the first birds had come in just a few days ago, and we're expecting many more in the next week or so.
It's so shocking to hear those numbers, you know, 12 million birds and the precipitous decline in the numbers of the red knot themselves. But I'm wondering for you, beyond the numbers, actually seeing their migration, following their journey, what did that reveal to you?
Well, I guess I was both saddened to see the bird go on the threatened and endangered species list, because it's a monumental thing to make a decision that a bird is at risk of becoming extinct. And being threatened on this list means that if we don't change how we're providing safe harbor for them, they will in all likelihood become extinct. I was happy because maybe that means the resources will be put to bear to actually help these birds. I realized you can't be anything but stupendously impressed by the resilience and the tenacity of the birds. They've come through difficulties before. The ones they're facing now are particularly challenging, but if we just give them a little breathing room, they're going to be fine.
Deborah Kramer, thank you for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Deborah Kramer is a visiting scholar at MIT and author of The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and One Epic Journey. For more on the book, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, where you can subscribe to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR on iTunes. And if you like the podcast, write a review, pass it on, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.